You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Tirza Latimer. Tirza, thanks so much for being with me today from San Francisco, correct?
Yes, from San Francisco. I'm happy to be with you.
Tirza, let's talk about the book you're working on now, which I think will help us to focus on a lot of the work you've been doing over the years. What is your current book that I know is in the gap stages of galleys now? Is that correct?
Yes, I just finished proofing my book, which is 5 years in the making, and a slim volume devoted to the notion of eccentricity and how important that is in the formation of cultural identity and production of culture. It's called Eccentric Modernisms, Making Differences in the History of American Art. And in the beginning, I called it Queer Modernisms to myself. And then I found myself writing explanation of what I meant by queer every 3 or 4 pages, and to make sure that queer in people's, the potential reader's mind, didn't reduce to gay, lesbian, bisexual, transsexual, that it wasn't necessarily even attached to a specific notion of sexuality, but was a more general and more capacious term, as it was when it was first coined by activists and scholars. So I got tired of doing that, and it was very repetitive, and it may not have been entirely necessary, but I chose the word eccentricity in my title in order to just avoid that task. And then I, of course, ended up having to explain that by eccentricity, I meant queer. So I never really did quite resolve that conundrum. But nevertheless, I've worked through this notion of eccentricity, the quality of deviating from the norm, or not being situated in the center, in ways that I think explain particularly modernism and the art of the early and middle 20th century as something other than a kind of autonomous, formalist history that goes sort of from one great signature to another. And I look at people who practiced in genres that can't be easily described by one simple heading like painting or sculpture. So their practices are kind of eccentric, in many cases hybrid. I look at artists who work collaboratively or collectively rather than the sort of single artist genius that is typically the focus of art history. And I look at places like Hartford, Connecticut, where modernism really had made a radical intervention into American culture in the 1930s, rather than focusing on our more famous art capitals like New York or Los Angeles or Paris.
So let's talk a little bit about some of those examples. We can talk about some of the cities, but perhaps, as you were saying, you know, the conundrum that's not completely resolved, you know, between eccentric and hybrid forms and also what I guess is typically a kind of now definition of what queer studies means, which often, you know, relates to a sexual preference or something like that. What would be an example of to talk about this way of looking? Maybe you could use an artist or an institution or something from your book that may point towards that not necessarily conundrum, but give us an example of how that illuminates history.
Yeah,
to some degree.
Definitely. My book is very grounded in three case studies, and one of them is an opera that was produced in 1934 in Hartford, Connecticut, at the Wadsworth Athenaeum, in their little theater in the basement. And the opera is called Four Saints in Three Acts, and it was the libretto was written by Gertrude Stein, and Gertrude Stein is a figure who threads in and out of all of the stories I tell, but she's kind of, she's not a protagonist. She's really more of a sort of backseat driver. All of the characters in the book relate to her in some way. So this opera was a collaboration that involved Gertrude Stein, of the American modernist composer Virgil Thompson, who was gay, and a circle of friends of his who were protégés also of Stein's, who were visual artists. And it also involved Frederick Ashton, who choreographed it and came over from London to work with this band of boyfriends, essentially. Gertrude Stein never came to America to work on it, but her text was sort of the foundation of the project. And so this collaboration among these men who were lovers and friends and supported each other's careers and worked interdisciplinary ways and had extensive cosmopolitan networks of kindred spirits, whether or not they were gay. This is one of the manifestations I look at of what I describe as eccentric modernism, and it made quite a splash in Hartford in 1934, and was picked up subsequently by the Living Theater and Mark Morris and a number of contemporary. Robert Wilson, a number of more contemporary artists who also felt an affinity, I think, with the project because precisely of its, using the term kind of loosely, queerness. So the one really outstanding thing that cannot fail to be discussed in relation to this opera, aside from the sort of gayness and campiness of its aesthetic and of the team of collaborators, including Gertrude Stein, of course, was the collaboration of people who really didn't identify in that way but are very eccentric in their own ways. And one was Florine Stettheimer, the spinster artist who lived with her sisters and her mother and produced fabulous sort of magic realist, I guess you'd describe them, paintings of her contemporaries. And Florine Stettheimer created the sets and the costumes for this opera. And it was the first time in an American opera that an artist actually was recruited to do the stage design, sort of taking after the Russian ballet in Europe.
And so who did the stage design?
Florine Stettheimer.
Wow.
So then we're taking eccentric and queer kind of out side of the narrow confines of sexual object choice, and just saying, yeah, this is queer in the eccentric sense of the term. And then the other queer thing about the opera in the eccentric sense of the term was that it was the entire cast was African American. So the first time an African American, a group of African American performers, dancers and chorus, performed on a high art stage, an opera stage, in the United States. And that in and of itself is such a non-normative gesture that it doesn't sound quite right to call it queer, but it's definitely eccentric in relation to sort of the conventions of opera on the one hand, and even high art more generally in the U.S. or elsewhere. So that's an example of this, you know, the use of this term eccentricity as something more capacious that indicates a broader refusal of convention and a sort of an exceeding of templates in specific artistic genres, but also socially.
It's fascinating that example too is from so long ago. You said that was
1934. It premiered. Yeah.
Amazing.
And then it didn't play in Hartford for all that long, but people came out on the train all the way from New York. They came down from Boston. They came up from New Haven. That wasn't far to go. But there were I don't think Hartford had a lot of hotels necessarily in 1934. I haven't really done the research. But it was very difficult, according to the correspondence that I studied at the Beinecke Library, among the patrons of this group of artists and of this production. It was really difficult to find a hotel room anytime during the run of the opera in Hartford. So it was a pretty big success, and it did go on to play on Broadway in New York for weeks and weeks, and then it went on to play in Chicago. So it was a sensation in its time. And then it sort of dropped off the charts, except for within certain very adventurous and vanguard companies like the Living Theater, for example, or Robert Morris's it was in his pantheon. People like right. Yvonne Rainer or folks at the Judson Memorial Church had heard tell of it and were familiar with it. In the underground, almost in the cultural underground, it had a very healthy life, and was passed down.
And I would imagine would be controversial in a more mainstream audience. I don't know how Hartford received that then, but I would think
absolutely
that would be,
would, yes. And to the credit of Hartford, Hartford was really quite open to it. But a lot of the critics coming down from New York and Boston had, were not as enthusiastic about it. Felt very talked about the cast in the most flagrantly stereotypical terms. But it did, it unsettled some ideas about what. What modernism was, for sure, and what ballet was and what opera was.
And when we look at that in the context now of queer studies, or again the lens of looking at that as in terms of as a lens for history, is it more your particular point of view, or has this changed over the course of history? When I think of queer studies, in academia. I always imagine that we're talking about gay, bisexual, transgender issues, but this term has changed over time. Is that correct?
Yes, that is so. And thank you for asking that question. I think it's really a key question because queer studies, I would say LGBT studies, is something that I would distinguish from queer studies. And queer studies could be looking at what everybody thinks of as straight culture for the embedded, the kind of DNA of queerness. And by that I don't mean, closeted queer artists. I mean more something a little more subtle than that, about the way that culture happens and the way that queerness and queer people have always been a part of that because, well, I don't know, you know, for one thing, I think it takes a lot of creativity to be a despised minority and survive. So, and making visual codes and performance are very much a part of that. How do you recognize, you know, an ally, and how do you attract a lover? So I think that those skills have been honed by you know, over time, and the fact that creative life and that culture is produced in sort of these zones where, like the theater, where conventional behavior and expectations of, you know, what proper social behavior looks like are sort of suspended in order to allow artists to have this creative bandwidth. And they're allowed to be different. And I think a lot of queers and people who feel different for one reason or another have been attracted to environments like that where it's okay to be. Not only is it okay, it's an expectation that you be precisely eccentric. And so you have both license reward in a certain way to express differently, and that includes gender expression in the arts. So queers have always been a very rich resource for culture. And I think looking at how, you know, something like color field painting that doesn't seem particularly gendered, or collage that a priori isn't a queer practice, looking at things like that in ways that acknowledge the importance of suspending a sort of established social value system and hierarchy in favor of allowing an openness to something different happening. I think that looking more generally at culture as, well, fundamentally a kind of queer contract is not uninteresting. You know, it has to be argued, but that's what I think queer studies does. And LGBT studies, which I also think has a very valuable place in our system of knowledge formation and the way that we learn and what we learn about, that adheres more to a kind of recovery project, I guess, or let's acknowledge people and their creativity that in the past have been dismissed or worse. And I think that's hugely important as well, but it's a slightly different project. And the book that I am talking about and my work more generally, I think does both. I'm not really making a judgment and saying that a recovery project in some way that's about acknowledging and affirming artists who have been edited out of our cultural history. I'm not saying that's unimportant, but that's not all there is. There are larger implications to what happens when you begin to see culture in a less strictly hierarchical way, where you start to see, it's not so bad that the art world is a social context, and that social connections are important. Maybe it's not always about money. Maybe it's about community building and supporting each other, and maybe things that look like they are highly individualistic practices conform to our values of individuality and singular greatness. Maybe every work of art is a collective or a collaborative work of art, and maybe every act of cultural production has an important debt to a context that's supportive and collective. And maybe that is a queering of sorts of the our way of appreciating art and artists.
That makes a lot of sense to me, and I think in the if this isn't too much of a reach, like now I'm reading the writings of Rothko, you know, before he even started the work that we know of, and Motherwell too, and if I'm understanding correctly, Rothko speaks to this in some degrees. You know, he begins one piece of writing by saying, the way the artist is viewed today by most people is as in different circles, which is something of a moron, someone who is fatuous and funny, but really and Motherwell touches on that too. This notion of the artist as someone who people can't quite comprehend what they're doing and has to be convincing of the validity of what they're doing. And in the context of what you're saying, that seems so clear that in a sense what they are talking about is a type of queerness, right? And it's and them supporting that, and as well as you supporting that in a way, support in general. Student, and as my wife and I were talking to him on the way out, we asked what is he going to do, for he was just getting out of undergraduate school, and he said, well, I'm going to go to California, and I think I'm finally comfortable with the fact that I'm weird and I'm an artist, and I'm proud to say that I'm weird. And now that I think of what you're saying, that's an artist paradigm, really, this kind of queerness.
It totally is. Yeah, it totally is. And then the irony is that it's a paradigm, it's a must. But on the other hand, somewhere a lot of times, like somebody like Clement Greenberg had to draw the line, like, yes, these are outsiders, they're weird, they're exceptional, they're geniuses, they're not, they're not your everyday person. They are eccentric, but the profile of the artist, on the other hand, you can't get too out there. It wouldn't be great to include every form of weirdo in, in the potential pantheon of great art. It gets a little dicey at certain times around, homosexuals aren't really quite part of the profile that we carefully want to edit this so that there's, certain forms of eccentricity are authorized and indeed necessary, but others are, it comes a little too close to home, and it drags down the brand, so we have to be careful to distinguish our He-Men, Jackson Pollock, et cetera, from these, crazy fairies who are running around New York doing, bizarre surrealist stuff. So that there's this funny kind of, exiling, I guess, of certain forms of difference from within a sector that really is in a statutory way supposed to be different.
Fascinating. And so your book is obviously with these case histories, looking at these people historically, looking at this notion historically, and although that is a, as you just articulated, somewhat of a slippery notion in terms of exactly what it applies to and what doesn't, and how certain artists or figures, you know, come into this inner circle or not. Nevertheless, this is what your book is articulating, the context that all these artists
It absolutely is, and I think that, you know, to be a sort of mainstream artist genius, you know, gold standard, modernist icon, was also to be male, and certain notions of Americanness after the Second World War were really important, and so all of the sort of more cosmopolitan, scions of the Paris School were not quite red-blooded enough to make the grade in that discourse that was forming about virility and American art. So sort of moving into the mid-century. So there too, in one way or another, sexual subjectivity or queer subjectivity is part of a discursive battleground, I guess, about what an artist looks like, what an artist can look like, and it is moving towards this notion of purity and masculinity. And the discourse.
Well, but part of the problem with that is in the notion of queerness that there isn't a definition. Part of what it means to be eccentric is breaking all those.
That's exactly right. Exactly right. And part of what it looks like to be American or is to be American is equally a mosaic and not something that's homogenous. And so there are the two things going on. At the moment I'm looking at in the 1940s in the United States, in the art, in the artistic sector, the things, the discourse of Americanness and the discourse of modern art are kind of coming together in ways that leave out a lot of the diversity that really, really enriches both things, both art and Americanness.
Fascinating. It's I'm looking forward to the book. What you're reading at the moment, if you don't mind sharing that with us.
Oh, no, I don't mind. I've been on a Maggie Nelson binge, and I just finished The Argonaut, and I'm reading, going backwards to an earlier publication, Blue.
Teresa, thank you.
I really appreciate the platform and being able to kind of reach out about this work, because I take it very much to heart, but I also think that art is like such a marketplace, so many values are and assumptions are embedded in the monetary kind of values that we assign to art, and what people look at and what museums acquire and what gets exhibited and what doesn't. And I really just feel like we're sometimes selling ourselves and our spiritual ancestors and blood relatives in some cases short by not kind of sometimes questioning the underlying assumptions, and I it is my pleasure to do that, and that's what I teach, and it's what I write about, and if I can bend anybody's ear about it, I'm happy. So thanks for asking me.
Teresa, thank you.
Well, thanks.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.